November 19th, our class is on stories of men and women in the Talmud. It's the 10th class. Today the focus is a focus that's pretty similar to one or two classes in the past, Torah study and spousal intimacy. This is a story. We're going to do two stories today, I hope. The first one is from Midrash Leviticus Rabbah. I'll just remind everyone what Midrash Rabbah is. Midrash Rabbah is a collection of Midrashim, of Midrash, that's almost exclusively Agadah and not Halakha. And the Midrash Rabbah has a section on the book of Genesis, on Exodus, Leviticus, Deuteronomy, and Numbers, that's five. And then it has sections on the five scrolls, right, which is Esther, Lamentations, Ecclesiastes, Ruth, and the Song of Songs. And why is it on the five books of Moses, on the five scrolls? Because these are read in synagogue, the five books of Moses in synagogue, and the five scrolls, each of them is read as a different holiday, right? Ruth is read on Shavuot, Shir Shirim, the Song of Songs, is read on Pesach, Ecclesiastes is read on Sukkot, Lamentations is read on Tisha B'Av, and Esther, of course, is read on Purim. So that's Midrash Rabbah, 10 sections, five scrolls, five of the books of the Torah. Now, each of the 10 sections of Midrash Rabbah is a different Midrash. They're not by the same author, not in the same period, but they've all been put together into this section, into this collection called Midrash Rabbah. And now we're looking at Midrash Rabbah on the book of Leviticus. Here we go. Ready? I'll read through the whole story, then we'll go back and read it again, word by word and line by line. Rabbi Meir was sitting and speaking about Torah on Shabbat night. A certain woman was sitting there listening. His talk lasted too long.
Too late.
She waited until he was finished speaking. Then she went to her home and found that the lamp was already extinguished. Her husband asked her, "Where have you been?" She told him, "I've been sitting and listening to a rabbi." The husband said to her, "I swear by such and such that you are not to enter here until you go and spit in the rabbi's face."
Oh, my goodness.
They sat separated for 1 week, a second and a third.
Well, wait, who sat? The husband and wife?
Yes.
Well, I understood they always sit separately.
It means that they separated. Her neighbors told her, "You have a quarrel. Let us go with you to the rabbi." When Rabbi Meir saw them, he envisioned the reason for their coming by means of the Holy Spirit. Pretending to have something wrong with his eye, he said to them, "Is there among you a woman skilled in reciting a charm for the eye?" Her neighbors said to her, "Now go spit in his face and you'll be permitted to live with your husband again." So she came forward, but when she sat down before his face, she cringed before his presence. She confessed, "My master, I do not know how to recite a charm for healing the eye." But he said to her, "Just spit seven times and I will be healed." She spat in his face seven times. Then he said to her, "Go and tell your husband, you asked me to do it only once, but I spat seven times." His disciples said to him, "Master, is the Torah to be treated with such contempt? If you had only told one of us to recite the incantation for you." Rabbi Meir replied, "Isn't it enough for Meir to be equal to his maker?" Rabbi Ishmael taught, "Great is peace, so that God's holy name written in sacred fashion is as commanded by the Holy One to be obliterated in the water, in order to bring about peace between a man and his wife." I am sure that much of the story was unclear.
No, you have just explained something I never understood.
Wow.
My grandmother, if I had something in my eye, she would go poo, poo, poo seven times, and then she would clear it.
Really?
And she was not a religious woman, and I never could understand why it was spitting seven times before she took something out of my eye.
Really?
I've never heard this.
Okay.
Poo, poo, poo. Was common.
Well, not in my family. It was
okay. Let's go back to the story. So
this is,
first of all,
like
Rabbi Meir, at the beginning, was sitting and speaking about Torah on Shabbat night. So he is teaching a class. He's teaching a class that's not just for the scholars in the Beit Midrash. It's a public class. We don't know if mostly men went, if mostly women went, if it was a mixed audience. And we shouldn't assume, we should not assume that this shiur, this class, was after services and after the Shabbat meal. We don't have to assume that. In those days, it could have been different.
What days would you say it was?
Well, Rabbi Meir lives in the time of the Mishnah. We took that about 100 years after the Common Era. So, most probably, it's not that they went to a Shabbat service and then went home for dinner and then she went to the class. Rather, there was no Shabbat service, or she didn't go. It wasn't that everyone went. And the Shabbat meal didn't take place immediately. First Shabbat began, and he gave this class. Then people go home and eat their meals, it could be. So he was giving this class. A certain woman was sitting there listening. Again, we don't know if she was the only woman, if there were other women there. His talk lasted too late. Now, that could mean one of two things. It could mean that it was too late in general. He went on for too long. Or it could mean it was too late for her. The talk was fine, but for her particular circumstances, it was too late. We don't know. She waited until he was finished speaking. And the fact that she waited means she was on pins and needles, that she wanted to go home. But she had respect for him. She also wanted to hear this presentation. She had respect for him. So she waited till he was finished speaking, and then she went home, even though she has an inkling that it's really too late. She should have gone home earlier, but for the reasons that she had, she stayed and listened. Then she went to her home and found that the lamp was already extinguished, the Shabbat candles. Now, what does the candle mean? It means they had, and this Stephanie knows very well, they had a little low ceramic dish, right, which is not open, but it's covered on top with little hole for the wick. You hear what I'm saying? Right.
I'm not sure it at all, but it's something like this. Right. It's a covered dish, ceramic, and it has just a hole where you put the wick in, so it's filled with oil. Mm-hmm. That's the lamp. And the Shabbat lamp had gone out, and of course, when the Shabbat lamp goes out, it's completely dark. It's not like Dallas, where there's lights in the sky, there's not electric lights in the street, there's not electric lights in the house, it's completely dark. And as we read on, her husband is very, very angry that she was late. So let's go back and try and understand what's happening here. First of all, let's look at the bottom of the sheet where I put a few quotes on the next page about Shabbat. Call the Shabbat of the light, but karat le Shabbat oneg. We know the word oneg, right? Oneg Shabbat, the light of Shabbat. Means delight for both body and soul, a delight for celestial and earthly realms, from the Jerusalem Talmud. So the reason I brought this is to remind us that Shabbat is about body and soul. As far as soul, we mean prayer and spirituality, we mean contemplation and meditation, we mean learning of Torah. All those things are in the category of nefesh, of soul. And then body. Shabbat is about having good food, it's about pleasurable company, it's about enjoyment, and it's also about husband and wife being together on Friday night. They're the whole unit, and the unit between spouse, it's all about both of those things. And of course the question, in very often in so many areas of life in Judaism, is how do you balance body and soul, physical and spiritual? So in this particular case, she's in the study hall. She is satisfying that part of Shabbat that's about the intellect, about the spirit, about God, about spirituality. But what happens is that it's not her fault, but what happens is she ends up neglecting her home, her unit with her husband. So the body part of it, the family part of it, they also didn't get to eat, apparently didn't get to eat together. So we have this certainly tension between two parts of Shabbat. Let's see the other quote that I brought at the top of the page, the back. It's a duty to eat three meals on Shabbat. And by the way, we call the third meal on Shabbat Sudah Shlishit, the third meal, right? The rabbi is used to prepare the richest food and finest wines that one can afford. It's really not just about the soul, it's also about the physical body having good food. And of course, in the case of our story,
this couple, they missed the evening meal, the first meal of Shabbat, because she was studying. So you can say the balance between body and soul has been slightly skewed because she was out studying. Which, of course, is fascinating, because we've seen so many stories in this room in which the balance between family and soul is skewed in the other direction. Mm-hmm. That it's the man that goes to the Beit Midrash and forgets about his wife at home. Mm-hmm. In this case, it looks like the tables are turned, and in a certain sense, the woman, it's not her fault, but the woman ends up favoring the Torah over her husband. Just the opposite of what we've been talking about. That's why it's so good to end with this story. Now, of course, there's a difference. In those other stories, the men went off for 2 years or 3 years or 12 years to study Torah. She went just Friday night. That's all she did. She did like, it's not like a, like she spent 90% of her time in the Beit Midrash, just Friday night, and everything already is out of balance.
Wasn't even the whole night.
Yeah, just spent just the 2 hours listening to a class.
What I find interesting is we found archaeologically, especially in the Golan, that women had their own study halls, and they would study separately.
I've never heard this in my life. And I wonder what period you're talking about.
Around 100 CE.
Their own study halls.
Yes. Women study together.
So I would really, I'm fascinated. I would ask you, can you send me something?
I will look for it. Yes. It's something I learned years ago in Jerusalem.
I don't know.
Reform.
I'm sure it's not reform. I brought another quote here. A husband eats with his wife at least every Shabbat Eve. Mm. Right? They should eat together. A Torah scholar should fulfill the mitzvah of his conjugal duties on the evening of the Shabbat. So that's part of the idea that Shabbat is not just about Torah, not just about the spirit, not just about meditation. It's also about the physical, about the meals, about the union between husband and wife, about being at home, about eating together.
It doesn't say they didn't eat their dinner together. They could have had it earlier or later.
They could have, but the fact that the husband is so upset, as we read on, looks like something is missing. And I'm assuming, I might be wrong, but it's possible that she went to study before the Shabbat meal. And the Shabbat meal never took place because she got home.
He could have waited.
No, but the candle goes out. How can they eat when there's no light at all? It's not like today, there's a little light from the street. There's no light. You can't see anything. You really can't see anything. Yeah. Yeah. So many modern people don't know what darkness is.
Oh, I do. I used to camp out in the Sinai.
Okay. Right, but here in Dallas, there's never any darkness.
Never. You never see any stars.
Yeah.
Do I misunderstand this, that in the ketubah, it's the conjugal duties are really directed to the man?
Yes. 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 All the duties directed to the man. Well, no, I'm sorry, not all of them. Not all of them. But most of them.
So it's not saying to the woman, this is your responsibility.
Mm-hmm. It's not a direct responsibility, but still you can understand how her husband is upset that she hasn't been there for the Shabbat meal, hasn't been there to be together, hasn't been there for everything. And where is she? She's studying. So,
and the rabbi should know better than to keep anybody
right. Mm-hmm. Good. Right. So then the question arises about fault. Mm-hmm. Right? She couldn't leave in the middle, although she perhaps wanted to. She couldn't leave in the middle out of respect, and she also wanted to hear the end of the class. And you wonder, perhaps the rabbi is a little bit
neglectful
in going on so long because it's preventing her and others from fulfilling the other side of the Shabbat responsibility about the family and about the body and about the physical enjoyment. So there's a tension here. Let's look at the next quote I brought. One should be very careful to light Shabbat candles, for without them there is no peace in the home. It's an ancient tradition going back to Moshe Rabbeinu that we must light Shabbat candles. So the Shabbat candles, and this is in the Talmud, they symbolize shalom bayit, peace in the home. Why? Because if there's no light at all, you can't talk, you can't do anything, you can't eat. There's peace and there's togetherness when there's light in the home. Now, let's look at this quote in a box I brought down here. This is by a modern... something happened to my photocopy. But don't worry. Okay. Those boxes got connected somehow. Mentioning the lighted home that was extinguished, the light that burned out, symbolizes the absolute coldness and the intimate relations between him and her. Because she gets home, they can't see each other. It's like they're not there with each other. The kind of lamp is a ceramic container, a round utensil in whose center is an opening out of which a wick burns from the oil within. It's not hard to see how the lamp overflowing with oil represents the woman and the wick dipping in it represents the man. So too, the rabbinic metaphor of two wicks in one lamp is a euphemism for a woman committing adultery, having intercourse with her husband with another man. That's Avigdor Shinan. Mm-hmm. He's alive today, teaches at Hebrew University. Yeah. I've had the honor of hearing a class or two from him. So, according to his understanding of the metaphor, the fact that the lamp went out is a symbol that there is now a certain coldness in the relationship between man and woman, between husband and wife. There's a certain distance between them, and the fault of it lies with the Torah.
No, it lies with the husband. The wick was too short.
No, there wasn't enough oil.
No!
I got you, Stephanie. But it doesn't matter. The fault was with the Torah. The Torah stands in opposition. Torah study stands in opposition to marital connection. Again, the same thing we had in previous stories, but there was the man that got overly involved in Torah, forgot himself, didn't come home. And remember some of the terrible things we saw. He was studying, used to come home every Erev of Yom Kippur, if you remember that, every morning of Yom Kippur. One day he was studying, he forgot himself, he didn't come home. His wife was at home, she started to cry. And then it says that the roof caved in and he fell. He was studying on the roof of the Beit Midrash and he fell and died. He was punished for forgetting his wife. But in our story, it's not that she gets overly involved in Torah and forgets to come home, but the Torah goes on, not of her fault, and she is not able to come home, and when she comes home, it's too late. Let's add a little bit more to this. Look at what I have in the box up here. Mm-hmm. Midrash Numbers, Rabbi. This is a second version of the same story we're reading, and I'm just going to read a little bit of it. Rabbi Meir used to give regular talks every Shabbat Eve. A certain woman of the town made it a habit to listen to his weekly sermons. So I just read that to show that according to this other version, this is not a one-time event. He would give a class every Shabbat, and she would go. She was always there. And one occasion, he extended his talk to a late hour. She waited and did not leave until he was finished. Okay. Let's see, what else are we going to add here? Okay, so now we're going to go back to the story. I'm going back to the story, to the first page. Her husband asked her, "Where have you been?"
He didn't know?
Well, it could be he didn't know. Or it could be it's a type of question that you ask someone when you are in a position of authority over them, and you know where they've been, but you want to hear them say. Remember what God says to Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden. Ayeka, where are you? God knew, but he wanted them to say where they are. So the husband is upset, right? He's angry. Where have you been? Now just remember that he can't see her and she can't see him. It's completely dark. She told him, "I've been sitting and listening to the rabbi." The husband said to her, "I swear by such and such that you are not to enter here until you go and spit in the rabbi's face." So he is throwing his wife out of the house for not coming back on Friday night, for neglecting her duties to the home, for skewering the balance between physicality and spirituality on Shabbat. And her punishment and her atonement is to spit in the rabbi's face. So why do you think it's spit in the rabbi's face? why not something else? What's the rabbi have to do with it? She could have come home if she wanted. She didn't come home. What do you think he's feeling?
The rabbi or the husband?
The husband.
Jealousy.
Yeah. It could be jealousy, right?
Maybe he thought she was having an affair and not sitting with the rabbi or having the affair with the rabbi.
Possibly. And even if he has no suspicions of an affair with the rabbi, with someone else, he could still be jealous.
Yeah, because he didn't fix Shabbat meal, or
why couldn't he fix it?
Well, why couldn't he fix the oil lamp? I can't understand.
No, the oil lamp and the meal were prepared before Shabbat, but the oil lamp went out.
So he ate in the dark.
Oh, it's Shabbat, he cannot put more oil in there.
No.
Yeah. Once the lamp goes out,
it's out.
So absolutely there's some jealousy here.
Mm-hmm.
He's jealous. It could be jealousy of an affair between the rabbi and the woman.
Mm-hmm.
But even if you don't go that far, here is this rabbi who's a male, and his wife is head over heels with the Torah that he teaches. Let's mm-hmm. think of him as a charismatic, powerful preacher, and this woman, perhaps other women, are deeply in love with the Torah that he teaches. And here's the husband at home waiting for his wife, and she's with another man. It doesn't have to be again in the sense of sexually, but he's with another man. And she gets great pleasure and enjoyment, spiritual enjoyment, from the time that she spends with this other man.
Is this the only time we've ever read about women studying Torah?
Yes, right. This is a really rare story. Mm-hmm. This story turns the tables.
And maybe, too, he's a little upset that it makes her look more pious.
Ah, yeah.
Than he is.
That can certainly be, right? She is playing the role that usually the man plays.
Mm-hmm.
She's the scholar
right.
who leaves home, and he's left like a woman at home waiting for the husband to come home. So it could be jealousy, but it's also humiliating. Like, he's lost his virility, waiting at home, twiddling his thumbs for his wife to come home. What's going on here? It's a role reversal.
Mm-hmm. It is.
One of the commentators that I saw actually goes in the direction that Stephanie mentioned just 2 minutes ago, reminds us that we certainly know today in the 21st century of some women who are infatuated with some televangelicalists, right? They have these very charismatic, handsome, well-spoken men attracting tens of thousands of followers, and there are certainly stories of affairs that develop between women and these preachers. And you don't have to look at it totally cynically. But there really is a great draw of spirituality. And that spirituality can become an affair.
Sexuality.
It becomes sexuality. And it's not, it's almost, could be a seamless process.
Mm-hmm.
In which part of the connection of the woman to Jesus, in that case, is experience through the relationship with the pastor, and the relationship can become sexual.
But his answer to the question is why she's at the studying Torah and he's not.
Yeah, why? Right, right. Why is he not there?
Is he giving it to the congregation, men and women, or just women?
But I said earlier, we don't know.
We don't know. And basically, now, do you have any examples of in Orthodox communities, the rabbis of the Shabbat teaching Torah just to women?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
On Torah, on Friday night.
Women rabbis?
Not on Friday night. It's not so accepted on Friday night. But there are very often classes that are only for women
mm-hmm.
under the assumption either that there's certain content that's just for women, or that women just feel more comfortable sitting with women. But while it's a totally female group, very often a male is found to teach the group.
But now, in modern-day Orthodoxy, do you have a teaching Torah to men and women together?
That you also have.
Some do, some won't.
It's actually very interesting that you have co-ed groups learning with the rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
You have female groups learning with the rabbi. In many modern Orthodox circles, the rarest thing is to have only male groups.
Really?
It's only female groups. Mm-hmm. There are classes that are billed only for women, because assuming that women don't want men there.
Well, how about Orthodoxy rabbis doing a one-on-one Torah class with a woman?
That's a little bit problematic. That gets into the whole matter mm-hmm. of counseling and therapy, mm-hmm. right? I have a comment here later that's going to go into that. We might not get to it. And how does the relationship develop between the rabbi and the client when the client is a female? It's the same thing you have with psychologists and their clients.
Anytime someone is helping one person, an attraction, because you're helping me.
Yeah, absolutely. These are things that are not just between clergy men and women. They're between
doctors.
Yeah.
I mean, if happens.
But especially psychiatrists mm-hmm. and counselors and right. psychologists, because of the very intimacy of the mm-hmm. things that are being discussed.
So I would go as an example, when I was in a corporation, I would, if I had a woman or a secretary or anybody in the office, I would always leave the door open.
Yeah, yeah. This is very dangerous stuff. So, look where the story is bringing us. So, the man, just going back, the husband, mm-hmm. is extremely upset with his wife, who we said has reversed the roles, mm-hmm. Who has...
taken over the masculinity.
Right. Has not kept the balance between the home and the study of Torah. And the husband is jealous for certain, and he wants to see his wife repudiate her relationship with the rabbi.
Wouldn't that mean the husband had no relationship with the rabbi then?
It could be that he never heard of this rabbi.
Mm-hmm.
But that doesn't have anything to do with the fact that he's a certain degree here of jealousy.
Yeah.
And he's upset. It's an affront to his home. And to his relationship with his wife, that she has a relationship with some other man. Okay, third part of the story. Mm-hmm. Let me just see if there's anything I wanted to add here. No, that's good. Okay. They sat separated for 1 week, a second and a third.
Separated inside the same house? Or
it looks like he said, you're not coming into this house until you spit in his face, and she refuses.
So where did she go?
Doesn't say where she went.
It's her house.
She went to her friend's house. She went to her father's house. She's living on the streets. Stephanie doesn't say that. Right? So neither of the parties is going to give in. They're pretty stubborn. Because, mm-hmm. of course, she's right, but he's also right. She is not going to go spit in the rabbi's face. She had a right to be studying there. The rabbi was a great man. How could she go and spit in his face? But as far as the husband is concerned, she has completely forgotten the balance between home and study. She has to repudiate that relationship mm-hmm. and now learn to spend more time at home. So who's going to give in? No one's giving in.
It's
3 weeks pass.
There's no mention of children or family.
Right, there isn't any. They might be empty nesters.
Mm-hmm.
They might not yet have children. We don't know. Her neighbors told her, you are having a quarrel. Let us go with you to the rabbi. So her neighbors, they are in favor of creating shalom bayit, of reconciliation. Whereas she and her husband are completely dead set in their way of that they're right. There's no way I'm going to go and spit in the rabbi's face. But the neighbors want reconciliation. So let's go to the rabbi and see if any advice, right? It's not that we have to go to the rabbi to spit in his face, but let's see what he has to say. When Rabbi Meir saw them, he envisioned the reason for their coming by means of the Holy Spirit. By the way, Rabbi Meir means light, enlightened. So he has great light, and he understands exactly what's happening, according to the story. Meir, right. And he understands what's going on. So before they even speak up, we see this really strange matter, pretending to have something wrong with his eye. And remember, eye is about light, right? He said to them, is there among you a woman skilled in reciting a charm for the eye? So he probably knows, and everyone probably knows, what your grandmother knew, that if you have something wrong with your eye, the way to deal with it is that someone spits in your eye 7 times and says a certain charm, and that deals with it. Again, doesn't matter if you believe in that or don't believe in that, but that's what they believed. So he immediately before they even tell the story of why they came, that there was a family dispute, etc., 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 he gives the woman the possibility of spitting in his eye for ostensibly the purpose of curing him. So Rabbi Meir is immediately willing to forgo his honor, right? Immediately in favor of Shalom Bayit, of reconciliation, even though he knows that this will be interpreted by the husband as a woman's repudiation of Torah and a relationship with the rabbi, right? So he's willing to sacrifice his honor and to sacrifice the honor of Torah and even perhaps to break the connection between this woman and the Friday night classes, all for the sake of Shalom Bayit. And then you might ask yourself, do you like those priorities? It might be that you don't like them. Do you like them? But Rabbi Meir doesn't say, this husband is wrong. He has to learn to accept your study of Torah. No. He basically says, I want to do everything possible to allow this woman to go back to her husband, even though the husband is a bit of an idiot and a fool, to go back to the husband. And even if that means breaking off the relationship with me, Rabbi Meir, in the study of Torah, Shalom Bayit is at the top of the list of Rabbi Meir's priorities, just like at the top of the list of the priorities of the neighbors. But of course, it's not at the top of the list of the priorities of the man or the woman involved. She believes in her Torah study, and she doesn't want to embarrass and humiliate the rabbi. But she's convinced, both by the rabbi and by her neighbors, that she has to put her Torah study aside and go back to her husband, even if it means spitting in the rabbi's face. So, we read on. Her neighbors said to her, now go spit in his face, you'll be permitted to live with your husband again. They're egging her on. They're encouraging her. She's very hesitant. She doesn't want to spit in his face, even though he said he needs it to be cured, because she knows that even if the rabbi is going to think it's for a cure, she knows it's an act of repudiation of Torah study, and she's not willing to do that so easily. So she came forward, but when she sat down before his face, she cringed before his presence. This great man, how can I spit in his face, even if he asks for it? She confessed, my master, I do not know how to recite a charm for healing the eye. But he said to her, just spit seven times and I'll be healed. So he goes on with the charade. Even if you don't know the charm, just spitting, all I need is someone to spit seven times in my face and I will be healed. So now, I want to come back to something that someone said already half an hour ago. Perhaps Carol Ann said this, that the rabbi, perhaps he made a mistake in speaking too long. Right? Mm-hmm. So when it says, I will be healed, what it means on the surface is healed of my eye infection. But perhaps there's something deeper here.
Learn a lesson.
That he understands that he spoke too long. Mm-hmm. He didn't give proper weight to the relationship between husband and wife. Mm-hmm. He didn't let people go home. Mm-hmm. And he is in need of repentance. And now he says, I'll be healed. In other words, by having you spit in my face, I'll be healed. In the sense of that will be an act of humiliation that I need to learn that my Torah is not so important compared to the relationship between husband and wife. So it's really a very powerful statement. Just spit seven times and I will be healed.
On the other hand, did the husband know that she was always studying Torah? Was he upset because she came home too late? Or because she's studying Torah?
Good point. Good point. That the coming home too late could be the straw that broke the camel's back. And he's really upset that every week she goes off, even if it's just for an hour, to study Torah. And then, of course, you ask yourself, so what does the author of the story want us to think? Is the husband right that his wife shouldn't be just going off for so many hours a day to learn Torah? Or perhaps we should be looking at the husband and saying, no, he's wrong. He's completely wrong. And it's him that is out of balance here.
So in other words, if she came home at 10 o'clock, it'd been all right. But now she came home at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Perhaps. I don't know more than you know.
Seems to me part of it is the rabbi's fault for choosing the wrong time to teach it.
All right, so you need to think in terms of, go back historically, how long... So you had to light the lamp before Shabbat.
Absolutely.
And so the question is, Stephanie, how long would a lamp last?
Depends how much oil you put in and the size and the length of the wick. It could go on for a long time.
Well, normally you would think that it's going to have to last until sometime about 10 or 11 o'clock at night.
But remember, oil is expensive. You don't want to put too much in. You don't want to put too little. You don't want to put too much.
On the other hand, there's a wonderful little oil lamp in the museum up in Old Jaffa. Mm-hmm. And it has a hole. It's on. It's like a goblet. It has a hole in the stem. And I found a plug next to it. And I realized the woman of the household, which gives us the Hanukkah story, was adding water to the bottom to save on the oil.
So that, that's very common. That's we also do that at our home.
But you could add more oil rather than water on the bottom.
But again, that costs money.
Want your wife to come home and see her or not?
There might not be that much money available in the chest. You have to have priorities. Okay, so let's read on.
I think Shalom Bayit is more important.
Shalom Bayit.
Yeah, I think that that she should have left and gone home.
I
understand. I understand the mm-hmm. struggle. If you're enjoying what you're doing, and you don't want to do that. But I think that it's more important. To go home to just excuse yourself.
But a rabbi should understand if women have to leave early,
of course,
to get home to eat and keep their husbands happy in the light.
That's the tension between values here. Absolutely. So she spat in his face 7 times. Then he said to her, "Go and tell your husband, you asked me to do it only once, but I spat 7 times. Now, of course, until this point, she doesn't know that Rabbi Meir knows the whole story. She didn't tell the story. He knows it through the Holy Spirit. According to the story, he knows it through his Holy Spirit. But now he reveals that he understands, and that this act for him was really an act of bringing husband and wife back together. Also, that was an act for him of, like we said, repentance. That he's learned his lesson. He's not mm-hmm. going to keep husband and wife separate in the future, because he's learned he has to speak for less amount of time. His disciples said to him, so their students are there watching all the time. They're learning Torah from the way that their rabbi acts. His disciples said to him, "Master, is the Torah to be treated with such contempt? How did you allow yourself to be humiliated?" Now look at another version of the story that I have here on the next piece of paper at the top.
Mm-hmm. One inconsistency here, that the neighbor said, "Let us go with you." So the rabbi saw them, meaning husband and wife.
No.
Right here, didn't it?
No, just with the neighbors. The neighbors. The husband, he's at home.
Right.
He has not seen his wife for 3 weeks.
Right,
he's waiting for her to come and say, "I spat in the rabbi's face."
Right.
Home stew.
So he hasn't eaten for 3 weeks?
Stephanie. I don't know.
I can make a sandwich.
So I'm sure he's eaten.
A different version, Midrash Numbers Rabba, his disciples said to him, "Master, is the Torah to be treated with such contempt? If you had only told us, we would have brought that husband and flogged him at the post until he consented to be reconciled with his wife." So, what do you think about the suggestion of the students?
They didn't want to see their teacher humiliated.
Absolutely. Right, they didn't want to see their teacher humiliated.
But if he blinked one eye a lot, no one would have been humiliated. They would have thought, yes, he had a problem with his eye. Yes, she cured him.
But a woman to spit in his face?
Would one of the disciples been happier doing it if he had an eye problem?
But he didn't have an eye problem.
Well, I'm just saying, he could have faked it.
So I have a question for you. According to the way the students would have done it, would husband and wife have been reconciled?
Mm-hmm. No.
No.
I don't think so.
You can force the guy to accept her back, but that doesn't mean any type of emotional connection.
No, it would have been lost.
But what's going on here, When the man hears that the wife spat at the rabbi, he is really going to be emotionally reconciled to his wife because he realizes that she has changed her priorities. And now she understands that really her allegiance should be to him and to the household and not to this Torah study stuff. But the students don't get that. They don't get that there's more to marital relations than being in the same house together. There has to be a certain emotional connection. You can't make that connection by flogging the husband.
Well, that's interesting because don't they also study with the rabbi? Doesn't he teach them?
Yes. And
they
what
must
he's
be very young.
Yes, and what he's taught them by not bringing the husband and flogging him, but by willing to be humiliated, he's taught them that you have to make certain sacrifices.
Right.
And that the Torah has to make certain sacrifices. The word Torah study has to give way to intimacy and connection and time spent between husband and wife. Okay, let's go back to the story on the first page. Part 5 of the story that we just began reading. His disciples said to him, "Master, is the Torah to be treated with such contempt? If you only had told one of us to recite the incantation," they think that he really needs the incantation, "we would have done the spitting. You didn't need a woman to do it." Rabbi Meir replied, "Isn't it enough for my ear to be equal to his maker?" And you ask, of course, what does that mean? So what's happening is we're going back to the story of Sota in the book of Numbers, the beginning of the book of Numbers. Remember the story? It's about a husband who's jealous of his wife. And he has reason to suspect her. So she's brought to the court, to the temple. And the ceremony that goes on is that a scroll with a curse that includes God's name is written. And then it's put, the parchment with the ink is put into water. And that water gets some of course, the ink on it. The ink diffuses. And then the woman has to drink that potion. And if she comes out of it alive, that proves that she has been innocent of any wrongdoing. And if her belly distends and she dies immediately, that proves that she indeed was an adulterer. And the rabbis point out that in 9 times out of 10, she's going to be a bit disgusted by drinking dirty water, but nothing's going to happen to her. In other words, the ceremony is designed to prove her innocence. Hear that? Mm-hmm. The ceremony is designed to prove her innocence, which means that it's designed to assuage the suspicions of the husband so that the husband and wife can get back together again. Now, there's a rabbinic midrash that says the following. Look at this. This parchment with God's name on it is dissolved in the water in order to create shalom between husband and wife. What does that mean? That God's name, God is willing to have his name blotted out in order to bring peace between husband and wife. So Rabbi Meir is saying, if God is willing to have his name blotted out, which is a great humiliation, to bring peace between husband and wife, then all the more so should I, Rabbi Meir, be willing to suffer humiliation to bring peace between husband and wife, especially since this might have been partially my fault, says Rabbi Meir. So that's what it says in the 6th part of the story. Rabbi Ishmael taught, greatest peace, so that God's holy name, written sacred fashion, is as commanded by the Holy One to be obliterated in the water in order to bring about peace between man and his wife. So Rabbi Meir actually is doing an act of amashio deo, of imitating God, by allowing his honor to be trampled in order to bring peace between husband and wife. So that's the story, the first story I wanted to study.
It's interesting because in the same period in Israel, they would have what they call execration bowls, about this big. And you would write, with using God's name, a blessing, or very often it was a curse. You would break it, part of it deliberately, and bury it under your home. Or,
and just to shatter the curse.
Yes. Hmm. But you would be buried. It would, you know, it was in Aramaic, which I can't read, except on coins. But once again, you know, it was put under the home, and the home is supposed to be the place of peace.
Okay, so it is a place of peace because the curse is shattered, it's destroyed.
It's also interesting, in Dallas we have had instances where a woman has come to the rabbi for counseling and there has been intimate relations between them.
That's the next story.
Yeah, we've lost a few rabbis, though.
Yep.
That's the next story.
I think this is an important lesson, though, because I think, I can think of times where I've not had a Torah study, but, went to do something else that I already had planned when Jay wanted, came home and unexpectedly, and mm-hmm, then, and mm-hmm. I just said, I'm glad you're here, but I'm going home to do this, that, or the other. Mm-hmm. Takes forever to forget that. Maybe you never forget that.
We go through this all the time.
I don't know. It seemed like he had hurt feelings for a long time, because I did that.
I understand.
And I thought that really was bad, It wasn't important what I went off to do. It was more important for me to have stayed there to do be with him.
I understand totally what you're saying. Mm-hmm. But a feminist perspective might say, why is it the woman who has to compromise her needs and her spirituality for the husband? Why is it always the woman who has to give up and come back home?
Well, we have a partnership. We take turns.
It should be both.
Really, today's world, it pretty much is.
You could turn it around and have it be the man, too, who runs off to do something. Mm-hmm. And, when you're left there at home, woman's left there at home with the meal and everything, and then, you didn't hear anything from him, and he comes in, late at night, and says, I had this work or that work to do or something.
Well, that's the secret. Never cook. Like me.
Well, in the story you mentioned before, about the guy who only came home Yom Kippur and forgot, and then was killed when the roof collapsed, it was God punishing him.
Yes.
Here, it was her husband trying to punish her.
Right. So you're right. We do have a certain equality here, that in both this... Well, that's not what you meant, but I'm adding that in both types of stories, the spouse that stays away for the purpose of learning Torah is criticized. But of course, in the male stories, they stay away for 12 years or 2 years. Here, she only stayed away for a night. It's a little bit of inequality, but that's built into the society.
I may be getting this wrong, but somehow in the back of my mind, I remember stories about Rabbi Akiva. And he would forget to go home. He'd be walking in the fields. He'd be reading. He'd be studying. He'd fall over things.
He went away for 12 years.
But I'm saying, when he was home, he would walk out in the fields and forget to come home at night. Yet you don't read these criticisms.
I don't know that's stories. And like Caroline said, the stories that criticize the rabbis for staying away too late, too long, those are not the Rabbi Akiva stories. Rabbi Akiva stories show his wife accepting it, and even
she
encouraging
was willing.
It.
Right. Wanted him
maybe
to go.
He was a nuisance at home.
There were different. We've seen different stories.
Yeah.
So the next story could take up a whole class, and we'll just have time to scratch the surface. There's the story of the goblet. Okay. Here we are with the story of the goblet. Let me prepare myself. Good. We're ready. Choma, Abaye's wife, came before Rava. She said, "Issue me an alimony decree to fund my food allowance." He issued it for her. "Issue me an allotment of wine." But he said to her, "I know that Nachmani," that is Abaye, "did not drink wine." She said to him, "By your life, sir, he did give me wine in a goblet like this." As she showed him how her husband used to pour the wine, her arm was revealed and light went out into the courthouse. Rava got up, went to his house, and demanded sex of his wife, Rav Chista's daughter. Rav Chista's daughter said to him, "Who was just now in the courthouse?" He said to her, "Homa, Abaye's wife." She went out after him, and she whacked her with her stick until she was driven entirely out of mechoza. She said to her, "You've already killed off three husbands, and now you've come to kill off another one?" End
all
of the story.
All this because she showed her arm.
Oh, wait a second. There's a lot in the story. I have very little amount of time to explain a lot of details. So let's go back to the beginning. Choma, Abai's wife, came before Rava. So now we have to know that Abai and Rava are close friends. They work together. They study together every day in the Beit Midrash. And in the Talmud, they are the symbol of the friendship and the love and the companionship of two Torah scholars. And they're also the symbol of great Torah learning. The Gemara is filled with the discussions between Abai and Rava, all the disagreement and all the getting to the deeper truths through their questioning one of the other. And they're both married. Homa is Abai's wife. Now the word Homa comes from the word home, which means hot. She's a hot woman, in some sense, as we'll develop. So she comes before Rava. She comes before her husband's study partner, and he's sitting in court. And she said, "Issue me an alimony decree to fund my food allowance." Now what that means is the following. A woman may have in marriage a food allowance, which means that all of the money of the household doesn't belong to the couple together, it belongs to the man. And he gives her a certain amount of money every week to buy food for the household. Mm-hmm. Now, when we talk here about alimony, we learn that Abaye has just died. And what happens is that when the husband dies, the woman doesn't get inheritance. The inheritance goes to the sons. But from the amount of the money in the inheritance, the sons have an obligation to support their mother. Now, in most cases, of course, it doesn't have to go to court. They'll just support their mother as they're supposed to. But in this case, for some reason, she has a demand of the rabbi, the judge, to command her sons to give her the money that they're supposed to give from the inheritance. And she's asking for the same amount of money that she used to get from her husband every week to buy food. Now she has to get that same amount of money from her husband's legacy, which is now in the ownership of the sons. He issued it for her. So he says, "Of course, if they're not giving you what they should give you, I'm going to write this document that says such and such amount of money that you used to get every week from your husband, you have to get now from your sons, from the money that your husband left." So we already see that this is a woman who's willing to fight for what she deserves. She didn't just sit at home and wait for her sons to support her. She went to court. And then she said, "Issue me an allotment of wine," which is the following, that if when she was married, she got a certain amount of money for food, then she deserves the same amount of money after the husband dies. If she got money for wine, a separate allotment for wine when her husband was alive, then she should get the same thing when he's dead. Let's think about that a second.
But so it's now, one person less.
Yes, and more than that. If she had an allotment for wine, well, what is that allotment for wine? In rabbinic literature, wine symbolizes lots of things and has lots of purposes, but one of the purposes of wine certainly is to create intimacy between husband and wife. When she says, "I used to get an allotment of wine," what she's saying is that myself and my husband used to drink wine together, which is opening a door to a whole world of connection and intimacy and understanding between husband and wife. Should she get that same allotment when he's dead? Ooh, that's a big question. Because that allotment of wine symbolizes or is a foundation for an intimate relationship with a man, but she no longer has that husband. What does she need wine for anymore? And to give that same wine, assuming she used to get it as a married woman, to give it to an unmarried woman, whoa, that's opening a Pandora's box. Here you're going to have a single woman whose name is Choma, which means hot, and she's going to have wine available. What's she going to do with it? So there's two questions on the table from the point of view of the rabbi who's sitting in judgment. Should he give her the wine allowance or not? First question, did she really have a wine allowance when she was married? And second question, even if she did, should I give it to her now that she's a single woman?
That weren't brachas?
Say it again?
That weren't brachas on Shabbat? I mean, why?
She still had to make up.
But she wouldn't make Kiddush on her own. She'd go to her son's house to...
So if she was living with her sons, wouldn't they be feeding her?
I'm not saying she's living with her son, but she would probably go there for Shabbat.
Okay.
So now look at the next line. Mm-hmm. But he said to her, I know that Nachmani did not drink wine. So first of all, remember, the man who's sitting in judgment now mm-hmm. was the best friend of her deceased husband. Mm-hmm. And he uses the name that only his close friends call him, Nachmani. And he says he didn't drink wine. In other words, you have to understand what's going on here. Rava knows the deceased Abayi as a study partner. They spent all day together in the study hall. And they ate together and they drank together and they loved each other. They knew everything about each other. But it turns out that Rava didn't know that Abayi drank wine with his wife when he was alive. Which means that Abayi lived a double life. He lived in the Beit Midrash with his best friend. But when he went home at night, they drank wine together. They had an intimate relationship. But Rava knows nothing about the intimate relationship that Homa had with Abayi. He only knows the intimate relationship he had with his study partner. So there are two different worlds here that are now mm-hmm. colliding. Because she has just told Rava that your study partner was also my partner. And Rava kind of thinks, no, he was my partner in the study hall. She says, no, he was my partner in bed. And now Rava is confused. He's now learning that his study partner had a whole nother life. Now, of course, we all know that people have other lives after they leave the classroom, but to actually be confronted with it, Abayi drank wine with you. I thought he learned Torah with me. I can't square the two together. But he was a man of sensuality. He had sex with his wife, with you. How did these two things go together?
It's a jealousy.
And there's a certain degree of jealousy. I thought he was my best friend, but he was your mm-hmm. husband? How do you square those two things? So she said to him, by your life, sir, he did give me wine in a goblet like this. So now she has to describe the goblet. And what does this goblet symbolize? It symbolizes the connection between husband and wife. It's the goblet mm-hmm. into which wine was poured that served as the grease that created the intimacy between husband and wife. As she showed him, her arm was revealed and light went out in the courthouse. So it doesn't just mean that she said, here's a goblet, he poured wine into it. She started to reenact the sensual relationship she had with her husband. She almost had a need to prove to Rava, yes, he was my husband. And we did have a relationship. It wasn't just with you and the Beit Midrash. This was my husband who I loved and he loved me. And we had this wonderful relationship. And Rav is kind of incredulous. Is this really true? What type of man was my study partner Abayi? Did he have this sensual relationship with this beautiful woman? And now she's in front of me describing the relationship she had with him. And light went out in the courthouse, which means, could mean a lot of things. It means he had a revelation. Abayi was another type of man, not just the type of man I had. It also could mean that the court is now filled with her sensuality, because she's trying to, and she might be very, very sick for him, lovesick for a husband she just lost, and she's describing to another man her sensual relationship with the deceased. And who knows if she doesn't see in the study partner, Rava, a replacement for her husband. Is she trying to seduce him? If yes, is it conscious? Is it unconscious? Is she not trying to seduce him at all? Is she unaware of the atmosphere that's being created? But in any case, look what happens next. The bell's ringing, we have to go. Rava got up, went to his house, demanded sex of his wife, Rav Chisda's daughter. So what happened? He became somehow aroused by the relationship with this client who came to ask for a alimony payment that really represented the sexual relationship between her and her deceased husband. At home, you could look at the different interpretations that I brought for actually what's going on here. But I'll just say that Rav Chista's daughter said to him, who is now in the courthouse? Yeah. She immediately gets that something's wrong here. Her husband comes home from Beit Midrash in the middle of the day and somehow becomes intimate with her. What's going on here? And he only says three words, Choma by his wife. And like she gets it. There's another woman involved here.
Women understand.
What's happening? What's happening? So again, I'm leaving the story to you because we're ending the class. Yeah. But she went out after her. In other words, Rav Chista's daughter, who doesn't have a name. She's just Rav Chista's daughter. Choma has a name. In other words, yeah. There's one woman who's, she's an event. She's a personality.
And the other one
another
is,
one
just
is just a good wife
his
at home.
Daughter. It doesn't say his wife.
Exactly,
so much
exactly.
As a daughter.
A daughter of Rav Chista. He married right. Rav Chista's daughter. Anyway, so she whacked her with a stick until she had driven her entirely out of Mechoza. This woman, Choma, who's now a widower, a widow, which means widow. That she's available, she's dangerous. She said to her, you have already killed off three husbands, and we have no idea what that means.
Sure
we do?
Three of her husbands or three
no,
of other people's husbands?
Say it again?
She's killed off three other, you know,
she's been married three times.
No, she could have killed off.
And after three husbands.
Yeah.
So. Oh, right. So it could be. Either it means that she's had three husbands who've died,
yeah.
Or that there have been three married.
Right.
Men that have somehow gotten involved in,
right.
With her,
right.
And she's dangerous. You've already killed off three husbands, and now you've come to kill off another.
Yeah.
Yes.
Which, kill off another doesn't mean mm-hmm. someone you're married to. It means a relationship
someone
is going
is
to
yeah.
Severely, severely undermine
yeah.
My relationship with my husband, mm-hmm. Says. So I'm leaving to you to read the
yes.
Material that I brought here, because we've only scratched the surface.
I think this is interesting.
But did she get her wine?
No,
oh,
stop
right,
whining.
Right. That right. That question remains open. Exactly. That question remains open.
I'm sorry, we have to run. We have to pick up our granddaughter, take her for a